From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made in what's known as the Wood Wide Web. Not the World Wide Web, the Wood Wide Web. Referring to underground fungal networks, technically known as mycorrhizae. I can't even really pronounce it. I'm not the scientist, but this is the way that trees exchange information and even resources. In short, it's how trees communicate and, yes, collaborate. Maybe you've never thought about how trees talk to each other, but ecologist Suzanne Simard hopes you will. Her pioneering work on the study of trees, especially tree sentience, has overturned the forestry industry's logic on denuding tree farms, on clear-cutting, and on replanting monocultures that has been so common. Now, Simard has survived grizzly bear attacks, breast cancer, the latter of which may have been caused by working with toxic herbicides and radioactive isotopes. She's been compared by some to Rachel Carson, and her new book is Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. It's being adapted into a film starring Amy Adams. Simard will be a guest of the Western New York Land Conservancy next week, but first, she joins us on Connections to talk about her book, her work, and what she wants us to know about how trees perceive one another, how they perhaps remember the past, and, yes, how they collaborate. I'd like to welcome our guest to the program now. Suzanne Simard, welcome. It is wonderful to have you on this program, and we've been looking forward to this conversation. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's really great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Kyle Semmel is back with us, communications manager for the Western New York Land Conservancy and man of letters. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
Very,
thanks for having us.
Very good. Hey, Kyle, why don't you just tell us a little bit about how the Land Conservancy put this event together and what it means to you to have Suzanne?
Yeah, absolutely. So in December of 2020, we all read an article in the New York Times Magazine, and it really spoke to us because we are a land trust, and what we are doing this year is, like we do every year, we're saving land. And we have a forest in near Salamanca, New York, called the Allegheny Wildlands, which is in between the Allegheny State Park and South Valley State Forest. And this forest is a 200-acre parcel that is really unique and truly wonderful. And so we thought how great it would be to have this expert on tree communications as, you know, part of an event that we could do to kind of highlight the importance of trees and tree communications as part of the work that we do. So naturally, I saw this. I saw that it was getting great buzz already even then. And so I contacted the publisher and I said, you know, we would love to have Dr. Simard as this event. And gradually it came about, and here we are today.
And the event, if you want to learn more, listeners, Wednesday, June 16th, jump on WNYLC.org for information. It starts at 7 p.m. It's free, but any additional donations go toward protecting the Allegheny Wildlands. So there you go. Suzanne, before we kind of dig into some of the research and the groundbreaking work that you have done, I just kind of want to go back and just talk a little bit about where you grew up and a little bit about your background that led you into forestry at a young age. Can you tell listeners about that?
Yeah. I grew up in sort of south central British Columbia in what we call the inland rainforests. And these are temperate forests, much like the forests along the West Coast. When you think of rainforests, you often think of these West Coast forests. But these are a little inland, and they're highly productive. They're these iconic old-growth forests with huge cedars and hemlocks and white pine, larch. They're really diverse forests. And I grew up in a horse logging family. So my great-grandfather, who actually came across from Quebec, my grandfather, my dad, my uncles were all horse loggers. And so they logged in these old forests, but it was selective logging. So they would map out the tree they were going to take for that week and basically just took a few trees here and there to feed the family. And those forests regenerated with great vigor. And you could as a kid, it was so exciting, of course, to be around this, but also it just seemed like such a natural way for the forest to recover. They rebounded so quickly. So that's what I got to know about forests and forestry from a young age.
Well, and my observation about what your career has produced, including this wonderful book, is that, you know, certainly you are a voice for change, for what the industry can do to change, not just sort of environmentally, but for what works for the trees anyway, for what, and we're going to talk about that. But what really kind of strikes me about what makes you, I think, different in a certain way is, if there's a criticism of modern activism, and I'm certainly not limiting your work to just activism. I mean, it's science, it's many years of work. But if there's a criticism, it's that often people who are trying to create change now haven't worked in industries or organizations or spheres that they're trying to change, whether that criticism is fair or not. That is not you. I mean, you went into forestry, and I think you found pretty fast it was very different than the kind of selective logging. But, you know, you're someone who has worked it, and you don't just denigrate it. I know you have some affinity for some of what you've learned there. Can you talk about how valuable it was for you to kind of go in and experience that with your hands?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I am a person of the woods, and I've worked in them my whole life. As you said, I've worked in all aspects of it. I started out, you know, as a young forester working for the forest industry, and I worked there for about 5 years. And I, you know, I was there, you know, laying out cut blocks and roads, and also, you know, watching them be harvested and then replanting them with seedlings. I did the whole industrial kind of forestry, and that's where, you know, I was, of course, always, you know, conflicted with how I grew up seeing how forestry could be done in such a productive way to this exploitation that I became part of. And this, of course, you know, led me on this lifelong path to figure out, you know, how these old forests worked and how, you know, the ones that we were creating were so different and not nearly as diverse and productive and healthy. And so definitely, you know, where I came from and my experiences led me to this career in research that really is trying to uncover these, you know, what I saw was, you know, the practice of disconnecting the forest of what I knew as a very connected and entwined place. And so, yeah, I mean, my experiences absolutely were crucial to the questions that I eventually went on to ask.
But you took years to answer those. I mean, I thought there was a really interesting moment where when you were talking to Dave Davies on Fresh Air, talking about how even at the age of 20, you're gathering data working in an industry, and it's clear to you that there are big red flags and fascinating discoveries and frankly, a need for change. And, you know, he asked you, you know, like, so what did you tell your bosses? And at the age of 20, you're thinking, well, nothing yet. You know, I mean, I know you, you, you know, why did you take such time to kind of put together a scientific answer on how trees were behaving, what was working for them, and why for so long things have been done so wrongly, frankly?
Yeah, and honestly, it was not a plan, right? It was developing through my career and wondering what was my place here and what can I do to make things better, and also like what's going wrong here. And so it was really like, you know, a crooked path of discovery and then trying to get people to listen. But, you know, that was difficult at that time, and it, you know, it's still difficult, but it, but then it was like, you know, girls were brand new to forestry. I was one of the first cohorts of girls to be allowed into forestry school. You know, only a couple years earlier did they actually open the doors, you know, to allowing girls into study forestry at university. And so we really didn't have a voice, and we definitely couldn't bring ourselves to the table, right? We were afraid, we were quiet, we were listening, we were hoping to be valued. And so, you know, it was a slow process, and looking for, you know, opportunities to make a difference. Like, because I knew in my heart, right, that wasn't hard. I knew that things weren't right, just from how I understood forests from, you know, from my ancestry and in my very DNA. You know, I understood forests at a very deep level, and I understood that what we were doing was very tragic for them, and so it was a matter of trying to find my voice, and at the same time doing careful research so that eventually, and even this was never a plan, but eventually people did listen, or they're starting to listen now. So definitely wasn't a plan. It was like stumbling along and hoping for a little space to get my word out.
I'm going to try to do my best with some of the science this hour, and I apologize for, you know, you're talking to a lay person. But I also, you know, just sort of as someone who likes gardening and, you know, enjoys the green space around me, one of the things that is just so central that I think people will really connect to is if people think of the trees, even if they have trees in your yard or if there's trees near where you live, we often think about competition. We think about, well, what are the roots competing with? What's planted too close to it? What can I do so this tree isn't competing with other things? What about these plants? What are they competing with? And we even people who are green thumbs often think that way. I've thought that way many times. Your book is the clarion call to really start thinking more about collaboration versus just raw competition. That's a big theme for me. And I want to start there as we kind of work through the science of what you have learned over the years. I suspect that wasn't as big of a surprise for you, given your background growing up. But how clear is it to you now that we have to start thinking differently about competition versus collaboration?
Yeah, it's essential. And really, you know, as I study forests, you know, and you understand quickly, and even, you know, just intuitively, we know these trees that, you know, grow up beside each other, live beside each other for hundreds, if not thousands of years, that they have relationships with each other, and they're sophisticated relationships. They're not just about, you know, trying to overtop and dominate another tree. They live together, right? And when you're in a forest and looking at that diversity of the trees, and you realize that quickly that, you know, they have their different niches, they have their place in that forest, and they contribute something, right? They provide shade for other plants, or they might, maybe they fix nitrogen and fertilize the forest, or maybe they're deep rooted and they bring water up and share it with other species. But all of these interactions, you know, include, you know, this, you know, an array of helping each other, but they compete at the same time, there's no doubt. And there's also other interactions going on, like there's some parasitism. There is, you know, there are things that we call in ecology commensalisms and the mensalisms and all these ways that they interact with each other. And, you know, we became so fixated, though, on competition. And that really came out of, you know, our ideas or Darwin's ideas or his writings about evolution, and that, you know, evolution is the result of competitive exclusion and speciation and natural selection. But that was sort of applied carte blanche to ecology and the application of ecology and forestry and agriculture without thinking that, you know, really there could be these, you know, this myriad of other ways that plants interact with each other. And so that competition theory just, you know, at the time when Darwin was writing was also when capitalism was being developed and exalted, and these ideologies sort of clashed and melded together. And not that Darwin was an ideologist, but his work was definitely, you know, portrayed and applied in that along those same lines. And so, you know, we developed all of these practices, like just thinking about forestry, about weeding plants and spacing them apart and breeding them to be competitive for light. And when you start looking, you know, at all the practices we do, we see how so steeped they are in managing managing competition. And in so doing, you know, we forgot that they also collaborate. And so take weeding, for example. We will go in and weed out the nitrogen-fixing plants. Well, if you weed out all the nitrogen-fixing plants, then what's going to add nitrogen back into those soils? Well, you know, we substitute that with fertilizer, which is very energy expensive, when there are plants out there that do that naturally. There are plants that naturally mulch the soil to keep water in. Yeah, you quickly realize it's not a very natural way. Once you understand this myriad of interactions, it's not a very natural way for plant communities to develop, just, you know, as we manage their competition. It actually makes them sicker in the long run.
Well, can you paint the picture for people who haven't, you know, worked in forestry? When you talk about monocultures, the long rows of one variety, that, you know, maybe we see it in garden centers, et cetera, but I mean, we're talking a pretty big scale here. What did you experience?
Yeah, and you're right about the scale. The scale is huge. So, you know, across North America, across Canada, where I live, you know, the standard operating practice is to clear cut. And clear cut means taking out all the trees, big ones and small ones, and replacing them with rows of trees. And these rows usually, historically, have been one species. You can call them a monoculture. I mean, they do have genetic diversity in them because they're bred that way and the seeds are selected in that way. But it's to the expense of the diversity of other trees, so that one species will be favored through subsequent practices like weeding and then spacing to make sure that that tree, that one that we planted, is the one that we're going to cut down in the future to make lots of money from it. And the cost of making these monocultures is that, you know, diversity matters to ecosystem productivity. And when you reduce it down to one species, and let's say something, some insect or pathogen comes in that's species specific, you know, take the Dutch elm disease, for example, which is a, you know, it's a huge problem. It's killing trees, or, you know, or other beetles like the mountain pine beetle, which attacks only lodgepole pine. Well, if you only have planted lodgepole pine, you're going to lose all of your trees, right? Whereas if you have a diversity of trees, like some aspen and some spruce and subalpine fir mixed in, then when that one specific insect comes in and is an epidemic, then you've still got a forest there. So you quickly see how diversity matters so much. And this isn't trivial because we are having these stresses in our forest. We are having beetles chew through thousands of hectares, you know, of forest. You know, we are having, you know, droughts that will, you know, affect one shallow-rooted tree species more than a deep-rooted tree species. So it behooves us to have better diversity. And there's many, much, much rich research to show, you know, that more diverse forests are more productive and resilient. And yet, you know, when we look across North America, we have not done that. We have really created a very risky situation with low species diversity and, you know, few old trees left in these plantations, another part of the story.
I've loved your description of when nature is really working as a beautiful cathedral of just sort of so much diverse color and function and form, mm-hmm. as opposed to just single line rows of things. And just as a complete aside here, I wonder if the American obsession with lawns, with monoculture grass and lawns, is sort of reflected out of this. I mean, I happen to live in a really shady space, and I've happily given up on monoculture grass. But in my 20s, I spent a lot of time trying to do that, sometimes with chemicals and whatnot. Why are we sort of obsessed with that?
You know, that's a really good question. I've thought about that a lot myself because it's like people are obsessed with lawns and certainly, you know, I've been, you know, my dad was really obsessed with a neat lawn for quite a long time. And I don't know, like making a space for kids to play or to, you know, have picnics, and that's all fine. But we could do that also in natural ecosystems.
Sure.
We don't have to have these clean, sterilized places, and they really are sterilized. You need to put so much input into it, like fertilizers and pesticides, get rid of the dandelions. And in so doing, you kill the bugs and the soil food web in that process. And so you create this completely artificial environment that requires constant upkeep because nature just isn't like that, right? Nature wants to fill in space with diversity, and we're trying to create these almost like linoleum floors for our lawns.
I have to say, Suzanne, you know, I appreciate the idea that some of these lawns are, you know, perfect, but the notion of those perfect lawns being spaces for kids or picnics, my experience is the lawns that are for kids and picnics are usually beat up and share the space with other plants and weeds, whereas the museum like ones, you know, you show up there and people go, well, you can't step there, you don't walk there. I'm going, what is the purpose?
What's the point?
You can't even step there. It's like being in someone's house, like a museum. Like, don't even sit on this couch. Don't even look at it.
Yeah.
Talking to Suzanne Simard, who is the author of the book Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. And years ago, someone much smarter than me told me when I was lamenting seeing mushrooms in my lawn after a particularly rainy stretch, He said, mushrooms are always information. So don't despair. They're telling you something. And I said, well, I'm not smart enough to know what they're saying. Well, it turns out in your book, you write about underground fungal networks. And what's the pronunciation, by the way? It's
it's mycorrhiza.
Mycorrhiza.
Yeah, myco meaning fungus and rhiza meaning root, and it's the relationship between the fungus and the root that that word describes.
See, that's where Dave Davies did so much better than I did on the pronunciation. But, you talk about information that you can gain from this. I would love if you could let listeners know your process of really discovery when it came to what you were finding underneath these trees and what it looked like when there was a sort of a healthy network versus when you saw the monocultures and what was happening there. Can you do that?
Yeah. Yeah. So, this, like we talked to earlier, this line of these, my inquiries were steeped in my whole experience from growing up in a, these old forests to being a young student in this industrial forestry. And then I was so, lucky that I met a man who was a scientist, and he got me working on scientific inquiries. And I feel like my phone is going to die. Can you still hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Oh, okay. I don't know why it just did that, but I just need to make sure that it doesn't die. So I'm going to move. Sorry about this.
Suzanne, as you move, let me do one thing here. Let me just jump over to Kyle just for a second, because I want Kyle to remind listeners about the event coming up, and then I've got a question for Kyle. Go ahead, Kyle.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure. So the event is next Wednesday, June 16th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. It is a free event, but we do request that you register. And to register, you can go to wnylc.org/events, and there you'll see the event there as well.
Did you find yourself rethinking your own planting strategy after reading this book, Kyle?
Yeah, I'm going to answer your question from before about the lawns, because there's actually an answer to that. And I will say that I certainly am thinking about nature and lawns and trees and forests very differently in the last couple of years, and certainly after reading this particular book. But the question about the lawns, you can find it a very convincing answer in Doug Tallamy's books on nature. So Nature's Best Hope, Bringing Nature Back Home. They talk about lawns historically, and I can't speak for Canada on this, but I can speak for colonial times in the U.S. According to this author, this convincing argument is that lawns were a status symbol. So people, you got Thomas Jefferson, you got George Washington, and many of the early colonial, plantation owners had huge lawns. And they imported a lot of non-native species into the United States to have these gorgeous, beautiful, English garden-type places or French gardens. And that kind of stuck as a status symbol. And so, and that's his argument, that we've kind of taken that tradition down through the, through the centuries, really, and we still have these big lawns. So there, I want to answer that.
Well, let me see. I've got Alex on line one who wants to, we're going to see if Alex is going to fact check on this one. How sure. Did Kyle do there, Alex? Are you there, Alex? I thought we had Alex. He called offering an answer on where lawns came from. And for some reason, I don't have them.
Well, I want to say that this is not my original thought. This is.
Oh no, I got you. Yeah. No, but we're going to see. Are you there, Alex?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to piggyback off. It definitely was a status symbol. It was basically to show that we are so wealthy that we don't need to grow crops on our own land because, again, a status symbol.
There you go.
We can basically just have a blank, long, unoccupied space just to say, hey, look at our property. Look at how big it is. We're so rich, we don't even need to grow crops.
Wow. Yeah. This lawn goes to 11. Don't touch it.
Anyways, thank you. That was it.
Thank you very much there. There you go. I got a Spinal Tap reference in there, Kyle Semmel. Kyle, when you read a book like this, though, I know you do a lot of work in the publishing industry yourself, I'm just curious to know how it sort of moves you and what connected you so much to this book.
So I'm glad you asked that question because, you know, this is, of course, a book about forests and about trees and tree communication. And it's also a memoir. And as a memoir, I think it's a really, really strong example of how to write one. So for the writers in the Rochester community, take a look. If you're writing a memoir, take a look at this one, because as a narrative arc, it really flows quite well. And it does so without veering into some of the traps of memoir, and that is trying to remember everything. But it's really, as you alluded to earlier, it's really focused on the drive for her work in the research into the forest. And it's a really, really terrific memoir in that regard, in that it's very focused. And you can see why they're making a film out of it, because it's a very filmic memoir in that sense. And so that's my answer to that. I think it's a really terrific book just as a memoir alone, let alone the actual, you know, thread or the theme of the book.
And isn't that sort of, Suzanne, isn't that kind of the tension here? Because, you know, so many people who appreciate your work are concerned that your work hasn't produced enough change based on what you've learned over the years. So you could argue that you haven't really been listened to. But on the one hand, Amy Adams is going to play you, so you've been sort of listened to. On the other hand, you know, you told New York Magazine that in some ways the state of forestry is even worse now than it was decades ago. Mm-hmm. So how do you see about whether your words and your work has been heard?
Yeah, no, it's such a good question, and it's an evolving thing. So, you know, my first work, my graduate work, I published in 1997 in Nature, and that was after years of doing my PhD. And as a young woman, you know, in forestry, where women's voices were basically not heard, or we weren't part of the scientific discovery. The way forests were viewed was really through male scientists' eyes, because that was who was doing the work. And so when I came along and did this work, there was a great backlash. And it was because I was, you know, partly saying, you know, there's more to the forest than competition and domination, that, you know, it was more of a female view of forest, that there were these many ways that trees interacted and collaborated. And yeah, there's competition, but there's a whole suite of, as we talked about, of sophisticated interactions. And so it was basically the best I could say is it was ignored, but there was also a backlash, both in the academic world where, you know, Darwinism is so deeply rooted, and also in the practice of forestry, where ignoring me was the sweetest thing that they could have done. But they also tried to, you know, really, when I was trying to challenge the practices of monoculture planting and weeding and all this, and saying, you know, you should use a more natural, holistic way of nurturing forests. And they were just like, okay, stop, that's enough already. And so I eventually left the government because it was so hard. But even still, there was very little uptake, you know, and forestry practices have not changed as a result. But, you know, but they're listening more now. And I think we're on the cusp of a change. And I think that there's so much going on. Like, for example, in British Columbia, where I live, you know, we're down to the last 3% of these iconic old growth forests. And people are protesting. You know, they don't want them to be clear cut. They want them to be left for their, you know, the very many values to ecosystems and people as well, like the spiritual quality of them, the fact that we need them for as carbon sinks and biodiversity hotspots. And so now people are saying, you know, maybe there's other ways we can do this. And now there's a little bit more uptake and paying attention to the work I've been doing, and others as well who have been saying, you know, basically have the same clarion call to let's stop already and look at what we're doing and maybe and conserve these old places.
Talking to Suzanne Simard, an ecologist, a professor in the Department of Forest and Conservation Sciences at the University of British Columbia, and the author of Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. And I've got phone calls and emails that I'll take after this only break of the hour. And we are also just, I'll take as much listener feedback, because I know people have questions on a wide range of subjects, and that's great, and we'll do that. But you got to hear Professor Simard just talk a little bit about what she learned about the way trees work together. It's not just, hey, you know, these different varieties in the same space, it's a good idea, you know, the soil mulches more naturally, it's better. There was some fascinating discoveries there, and I want to kind of go over some of that with you, because I think it's so great to kind of get a scientific grasp of this. And we'll talk about that when we come back from this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, we talked to a local engineer who recently wrote the story about when he was in high school and he was pulled out of class to be told that he was now homeless. Lessons on homelessness from him in our first hour. Our second hour, we take a look at the rise in alcoholic liver disease and some warnings, especially changes during the pandemic. We'll talk about it Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and someone's line is buzzing. Kyle Semmel, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, Dr. Simard, are you there? Oh, we don't. So let's do this. Let's go ahead and see if we can reestablish a connection with Suzanne Simard, who is with us. She is the author of the book Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. And her work for decades has, I think, really built up to this book that is, as Kyle Semmel mentions, yes, a memoir, but also a look at what she has discovered working in forestry, doing the scientific work to understand how trees are working together and, frankly, communicating. And, you know, as she has talked about in many places, there are people who think that that's a little woo or strange. You know, are you saying the trees are talking or thinking? But, Kyle, before we bring Suzanne back, I thought it was a very scientific book. I mean, I'm not – it's a memoir. I mean, it's not just all science. But I guess the point I'm making is – for the critics who would find it a little out there to think about trees communicating with one another, I didn't think this book was out there at all. I thought it was grounded in real experience and research and data. What did you think?
Well, I would agree with that, certainly. I the book is about forests and about tree communication. So in order to do that, you're going to have some data in there. But what I think she does do really well is ground that data in the story, the narrative of her life.
Yeah.
Whether it's the story of her parents, whether it's the story of her brother, her sister, her husband, all these stories that interweave this narrative, you really humanize it in a way that I think the data may, you know, the data may be sciencey, and for some it may seem like out there, but at the same time, you know, you have to have that to kind of prove these connections that she does so convincingly.
Mm-hmm. Let me get Kevin in Hamburg on the phone with a question or a comment for Suzanne. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yes. Hi, Evan. And thank you, Dr. Simard. It's wonderful to speak with you. I actually have two questions. The first one is I was recently listening to an interview with Robert McFarlane, who was discussing some of your work. And he talked about how some of it can be interpreted in sort of anthropomorphic lenses, either through like an altruistic or socialist sort of lens, where trees are all just sharing everything and working cooperatively, versus also it could be looked at as more of like a sort of capitalist or competitive lens, where even the sharing itself is a sort of a individual selection and competition itself. And I'm wondering, and he was essentially talking about how those interpretations don't really fit into a box. Ecology is always more complicated than that. I'm curious about what you think about that, or what the latest science is. Is it pointing in either of those directions? And then the second question is, I'm curious to know your thoughts on the character that was loosely based on you in the Overstory, and what kind of an impact that has had on you.
Thank you, Kevin. And,
yeah.
And Kevin, I'll put you on hold so you can listen here. Go ahead, Dr. Simard.
Okay, yeah, thanks for those questions. Yeah, I think, you know, we tend to, you know, think be sort of black and white sometimes, and really it's all shades of gray about how forests, just like in our own relationships, there's all kinds of nuances and variation in how we interact and communicate. It's the same in forests. And so to say, you know, it's only competition or only collaboration, both of those are wrong, right? It's a mix of these things. And so I think, you know, the importance of knowing that we tend to be like that, so black and white, is you can see it in how we practice forestry. Like I described before, the idea that competition was the only thing is really colored everything about how we practice forestry and agriculture, so much of it. And it's such a nuanced, complex interaction that's going on. So yeah, Robert McFarlane is right that, you know, that there that there is, you know, that people have been in these camps, and we don't need to be. We need to be actually working together to look at the whole suite of interactions that are going on that will drive better management. And this also addressed the anthropomorphism part. You know, the word anthropomorphism, it was invented by scientists, Western scientists, who it's kind of a way of saying, you know, we're removed from our experiments. These are our subjects, and we don't bring ourselves to the scientific inquiry. We're just observers. And in fact, we're superior to all of this, and that we're removed from it. And for a scientist, if you use anthropomorphism, or if you try to inject, you know, how you're interpreting this, or you brought yourself to the scientific inquiry, well, you're anthropomorphizing, or you're calling things, you know, in these anthropomorphic terms, it's kind of a way of keeping down science in a way. I mean, science is such a human endeavor, and I wanted to really bring that to the memoir, to say, you know, I ask these questions because of who I am and my experiences. And also, you know, the other important part of this sort of anthropomorphizing or derision of people who use that is that it furthers our lack of understanding of the importance of nature around us. It elevates us to being dominion over nature, and that's what's gotten us into so much trouble. You know, so I'm trying to bring people to understand forests as societies that are not that different than our own, and that using words that we apply to humans helps us understand that, right? And it also, you know, helps us embrace our naturalness, you know, and get us back into nature of where we belong, and that we are, you know, one and related to the trees and the animals and the fungi and the bacteria. We have the same ancestors, for Pete's sakes, and we need to treat them that way. And so I have a deeper reason for doing that.
I really appreciate the phone call, Kevin. Thank you. And I think building on Kyle's point about how you structured this book and how you really made the story, the narrative, connected with so many of the themes that frankly the science fed into. One of them for me is exactly what you're talking about there. We can anthropomorphize, I guess, or we can talk about how it seems like we're talking about two people when we talk about two trees that provide shade and resources for each other, the same way we would provide an umbrella in the rain or something like that. But you really found some remarkable things when you looked at the way trees would provide shade, yes, and then share carbon. Tell us about what you discovered and why it matters so much.
Yeah, so, you know, that initial research during my PhD, I was looking at these plantations that were getting sicker because we'd cleaned them out so much. You know, like the lawns, they're almost like lawns and, you know, without their natural diversity. And what I noticed was that there was disease spreading through these plantations. They didn't have their natural defenses. It's like we'd reduced their immune systems. And so there were these pathogens that were killing the trees. And so I wanted to know why. And I looked below ground where these root pathogens were using, you know, all kinds of tools, microscopes, molecular tools eventually, and found that we had disrupted the balance of the forest, of the soil ecosystem, so that these diseases could proliferate because we'd reduced the natural defenses, which was the diversity of the forest. In this case, paper birch was, we were cleaning paper birch out of the ecosystems without knowing that, because we thought they competed with Douglas fir because they grew taller faster, without knowing that these birches were actually fixing huge amounts of carbon in their rich leaves and allocating it below ground and then sharing it with the Douglas fir, even as it shaded the Douglas fir. And I think that, you know, that actually increased the diversity of the forest, which kept the disease at bay. It also, you know, provided carbon to host this complex soil food web, which also had bacteria that fixed nitrogen that allowed the birches to have rich nitrogen in their leaves that allowed them to photosynthesize at higher rates. And so you can see how these cycles and feedbacks work to create, you know, a more productive disease-free forest. And ultimately, you know, I studied that the mycorrhizal fungi that actually linked the birch and fir together was the conduit through which the carbon was shared by birch with fir, and that we were disrupting these networks. We were actually killing them in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, so we were really, you know, cleansing the forest of its natural system for collaboration and creating an immunity against diseases and insect infestations.
And so you had the evidence in hand, and ever since that day, the industry changed its policies, and I'm so glad.
I wish.
Isn't that amazing?
They tried to kill it.
I mean, it must be amazing to you to be the one, and I know you collaborate yourself and there's other people involved, but to be a person who was able to make this case scientifically with evidence, and now you look at logging companies and they are still flying around, clear cutting, spraying the clear cuts with Roundup. What is it like for you to see that even after your discoveries years ago?
Well, you know, I'm 60 years old. I've seen so much and how science is ignored, right? We have a scientific basis for doing such a better job. You know, science means something, and to ignore it is because it's not that they're not thinking about the science and the ecosystems. They're thinking about the profits they can make. And so, you know, then they twist, you know, their reality around to justify the basically exploitation of forests and saying, you know, you need to clear cut these forests because we can replace these old forests with young forests that fix carbon. You know, they sequester carbon at faster rates. Well, you know, what about all the carbon you just lost by clear cutting the old growth forests? You can never replace that. But somehow we've been able to justify and then propagate these misinformation to keep justifying the same old practices that are, you know, basically bringing a lot of wealth to a few corporations. And that's the problem, is that it's not that they don't believe the science, or that they just ignore it because it doesn't fulfill their motive.
Do you have a message for listeners who might use Roundup at home then, given the way how you've seen it used industrially?
You know, I would be so careful. A lot of foresters will say, well, we don't want to lose Roundup as a tool in the toolkit. Well, there are other ways to get rid of weeds. If you think that there are invasive weeds, for example, well, you can pull them out. You know, putting poisons on plants isn't a very sustainable practice. You know, it takes a lot of energy, for one, to create Roundup. It's not energy free. I mean, it costs carbon, it costs fuel to make these things. So that's one thing. And then it kills the plants, which are the drivers of photosynthesis, which drives the energy cycle in the forest and drives the nutrient cycles. And so you're kind of killing that part of the ecosystem. So I would say, you know, yeah, we can tend the forests or tend the gardens, but there are other tools to use other than using herbicides and poisons.
Let me get some more listener questions here. So Don wants to know, can you ask Professor Simard about the effort to restore the American chestnut? There's a GMO candidate that's seeking approval, and I'd be interested to hear what she thinks about that use of the technology.
You know, I don't know that. I don't know anything about the GMO for chestnuts, so it's hard for me to comment on that specifically. Certainly, you know, GMOs, I would be really cautious. I mean, I think we can breed trees for resistance, and we definitely do that. But that's totally different than GMOs, where you actually are doing gene jockeying to create, you know, to basically create these artificial trees, I guess. But there can be a role in tree breeding and maybe doing a little bit of, you know, breeding trees so that for resistance rather than creating trees that are more resistant. I guess I would be really cautious. I'm always cautious about GMOs because there's kinds of hidden risks involved in that, escapes into the environment. What are they going to, you know, how will they perform under different conditions? Will the seeds escape into the environment, and what will the consequences of that be? And we see that in agriculture as well, is the same arguments. And certainly, you know, I know in agriculture we've increased food production enormously through GMO work, but I just would be really cautious about using those approaches in, you know, wholesale, I guess, into create whole trees through GMO. I think breeding can be done, but I would be cautious about GMO.
Another listener is asking, can I get the book in audio format, and if so, where?
Yes, I've done the audio myself, which was an interesting experience. And you can buy it on Amazon or at Penguin Random House, which is the publisher. You can buy it pretty much at any outlet that's online selling books. And you can also go to, I have a website called SuzanneSamard.com, where, or maybe it's DrSuzanneSamard.com, and it's got linkages to where you can order the audiobook.
Benjamin is writing to say, prior to my mom passing, I recalled taking a ride with her to see my grandmother. On the way, we passed her favorite tree near Canajoharie, New York, off the thruway. It was an absolutely stunning elm tree that was dying from Dutch elm disease. It was heartbreaking for us. The phosphates and insecticides dumped all over this country are sad and silly. Let nature do its work and reap the beautiful rewards from the diversity and plant health it creates. Thank you, as always. That's from Benjamin. And as he talks about seeing a favorite tree dying, you have talked about that. What can we learn as we understand how trees die?
Yeah, you know, dying in forests is a constant thing, as is birth. It's a cycle of birth and death. Anytime you go into any forest, you'll see some trees dying. And dying is a process, right? It's an ecological process that's really vital to the health of the forest. So a tree, it can take years for a tree to die, or it can die all of a sudden as well. But that process is a period of giving back. And and so what I specifically studied is we've actually manipulated trees, stressed them artificially in the laboratory and greenhouse experiments, and found that as trees are dying, you know, as we stress them and cause them to die, like plucking off their needles, and that they undergo these biochemical stress responses. And part of that is actually shipping some of their carbon through their roots, through their mycorrhizal networks to their neighbors. And so they're dispersing their energy in quite discrete ways. It's not just like, you know, evolving back into the atmosphere, you know, at random. So it is very, it's a process, and not just energy, but information as well. So if that they'll actually send messages or information to their neighbors about defense, saying, hey, you know, I've got some insect, I've got some pathogen, and you should upregulate your own defense machinery, their RNA, and then they produce more defense enzymes, and it protects them against whatever is infecting or defoliators or herbivores or whatever is the cause. And so yeah, you know, dying is a process, and it's a period of a special period of time as trees die, that they're actually, you know, they were using their wisdom, I call it wisdom, to inform their community, and then as they do, they disperse their energy in very directed ways. You know, some of it is you know, obviously goes into the atmosphere, but a lot of it ends up in the soil, informing the cycles of recovery. You know, the recovery of new seedlings as they come up. They really benefit from that information and that energy of their old parents.
Nancy in Rochester writes to say, what can we do as lay people to help the forest?
Well, you know, here's one thing. You know, we have very few old forests left. You know, we've got patches in the Amazon, our West Coast forests, our northern boreal forests, but they're all, you know, being under a lot of pressure by corporations to make money from them. And so we're cutting down old forests for very, very, you know, not very good reasons, right, for profits. And yet these old forests are, you know, they're our life support systems. They're where carbon, huge amounts of carbon are stored. If we cut all of them down, we would swamp out our CO2, atmospheric CO2 already that's rising so rapidly. We would lose so much biodiversity. And so what you can do is you can join, you know, and support people who are trying to protect these forests. You know, and not listen to this false information about, you know, replacing them with plantations is better for us. It's not better for us. You know, it's better to protect these forests. It's hard to protect them. People are putting their lives on the line. And any way that you can support that is better for our whole planet, for all of us together. And, you know, if you feel like that's a bit stretch, you know, just one thing you can do is you can just go be in the forest and reconnect with it. And when you start to, you feel yourself as part of the forest again, then you might feel more, you know, more energized to go in and help people on the front lines.
And just 30 seconds, do you have any optimism that the industry will change and respond to some of not only your research, but some of what we've been talking about?
I think that it will, and I think it has to. And I think that people pressuring governments and industry to change is the key. Yeah, it will happen.
Kyle Semmel, Communications Manager for the Western New York Land Conservancy, close this program by reminding listeners where you'd like them to be to get to hear more from Suzanne Simard.
Correct, yes. Go to wnylc.org/events, and you can sign up for the event next Wednesday at 7 p.m. And I will add, if I can quickly, we do have the property that we are actually raising money to protect this year, the Allegheny Wildlands. We do have some naturally growing American chestnuts that, you know, we are just going to kind of monitor to see how well that actually, how they continue to grow in, into the future. And maybe that is part of the solution, these naturally growing American chestnuts that are there.
Thank you for this. And Kyle, nice to talk to you. Good luck with this event. And let's be in touch. We always appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having us.
Kyle Semmel from the Western New York Land Conservancy. Suzanne Simard, the book is Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. Wonderful to have you. Thanks for the insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
And our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, Emma Ray Stein, Evan Dawson, saying have a nice afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.